If you want to buy a new car and you have an old one to get rid of, you might be thinking about the government's new Cash for Clunkers program. You can get as much as $4,500 for that old car. Could be a great deal. But as NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, some charities say that the law will hurt them and the low-income people they try to help.
Emma Johnston needs a car to shuttle her three kids to school and daycare around Alexandria, Virginia. She also drives almost 40 miles to get to a part-time job and another 40 miles to paralegal classes.
My vehicle just went completely dead. Everything went bad. It was an older car. It was a 1991 Toyota Camry.
She's been renting a car for $200 a week, but she can't afford to keep that up. Someone at her church told her about Roger Penn's charity, the Car Ministry. It fixes up donated cars and gives them to people in need.
The vehicle we have is newer than the one you had. It's a 95 Oldsmobile Sierra, and it's in pretty good shape, and it seems to drive well.
As she drives away, Penn worries that the Cash for Clunkers program will make matches like this one a lot harder to make.
This is kind of a typical car that would perhaps be junked under this Cash for Clunkers law. But look at it. It's really a nice car. It drives well. Why wouldn't somebody benefit from that?
The Cash for Clunkers law goes into effect later this month. It will give people $3,500 to scrap gas guzzlers and buy new cars that go at least 4 miles further on a gallon of gas, or $4,500 if their new vehicles get 10 miles more per gallon.
Maybe the new cars will get better mileage, but what about the people who can't afford to buy a new car? They need transportation, and if they don't have it, they won't be able to get to work. They won't be able to get the medical help that they need because they can't get to dialysis.
Certainly, that's not the goal of the act.
That's Democratic Representative Betty Sutton of Ohio, one of the program's chief sponsors.
The act, of course, is to help consumers, help our environment, and to stimulate auto sales at this time when they're lagging, and so many families across this country depend upon them for putting food on the table and keeping them employed.
Sutton says in part because of charities' concerns, Congress restricted the program to cars that get 18 miles per gallon or less.
Actually, it severely cut down the number of cars that might be traded in under the Cash for Clunkers program, and thereby making all of those cars still available for charitable donations.
Still, charities say there's no question that the Cash for Clunkers program will put a strain on them. Usually, when someone donates a car to charity, the charity sells it and keeps the proceeds. Pete Palmer runs the Vehicle Donation Processing Center.
There's a whole industry that helps support the charities, including the auctions, tow truck drivers, and all of those people are going to be hurt.
Palmer's company handles sales of donated cars. Donors can take tax deductions for the small amount charities usually get for those sales.
Somebody has to be pretty darn altruistic to do a car donation over the Cash for Clunkers program if they want the new car.
Palmer's company and some charities are lobbying against an effort to extend Cash for Clunkers beyond November 1st, when it's supposed to expire. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Those are some of the world's largest companies. Well, what about the smallest companies, the entrepreneur trying to make it on his or her own? As part of our series on the future of capitalism, NPR's Wendy Kaufman explores the business climate for small-time innovators with big ideas.
Brian Lobsher is passionate about one thing, the space elevator. While it might sound like science fiction, it's a serious proposal to get things into space without using a rocket. For the project to work, you need cable that's ultralight and extremely strong.
And I believe it's going to be carbon nanotubes.
That's right, carbon nanotubes. Working from the spare bedroom of his Seattle-area home, the PhD astrophysicist is hoping to turn carbon-based material, so small you can't see it, into high-strength thread for industrial use.
I am looking at these scientific curiosities and saying, hey, we can take that and make something that people will actually buy.
Lobsher the scientist has become Lobsher the entrepreneur. While his idea is decidedly esoteric and perhaps overly ambitious, many of the challenges he's facing are common to nearly all new entrepreneurs. Their number one problem? getting enough money.
I think it's always tough, and I think it's really tough now because of the economy. My advisors are telling me that, you know, monetary investment is going away. Not that no one is investing in anything, but people have raised the bar on the risk they're willing to take. So they want much more developed projects that are more assured before they put their money in.
He'd hoped to get hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now he's making do with about $40,000. With fewer dollars coming from private investors and less credit being offered to startups, entrepreneurs with big ideas will likely look to government spending priorities, stimulus funds, and research grants. In short, they'll follow the money.
There's nothing harder for an entrepreneur than to try and go against the wind.
Jim Phillips knows a thing or two about entrepreneurs. He's a highly regarded technology executive, an advisor to the U.S. Council on Competitiveness, and he heads an Arkansas-based venture capital fund. He says now more than ever,
you need the wind in your sails. And so any boost you can get, you need to take advantage of. There's billions and billions of dollars going into things like biomedical research and climate change and sustainability.
And there'll be money for things such as smart manufacturing and nanotechnology. Phillips adds that where federal dollars go, private investors are likely to follow. These days, those investors will have startups on a shorter leash, and entrepreneurs will need laser-like focus to develop bankable ideas more quickly and with less capital than in the past. And in these tight times, only the very best ideas are likely to survive. Still, there are factors working in favor of entrepreneurs, says Jerry Engel, executive director of the Lester Center at the University of California, Berkeley.
The message for the best and brightest is now is a great time to start a venture.
He's telling students not to take crazy risks, but to seize the moment while the economy is in disarray and many existing companies are hunkered down and not taking chances.
There are those white spaces, we like to call them, those opportunities for people to step into.
Plus, with so many people unemployed and underemployed, there are lots of talented people to hire. Carl Schramm, CEO of the Kauffman Foundation, which studies entrepreneurship, cites some of those same things and adds another.
I think it may be something also even more important culturally, that in times like this, there's something in some subset of Americans who basically say, now's the time to do it. It's also a time when people see differently in what could be done.
But that optimistic picture is not shared by everyone, certainly not those recently surveyed by the National Federation of Independent Business. The group's chief economist, William Dunkelberg, says when members were asked, is now a good time to start a new business, only 5% said yes.
It's about as low as it's ever gone in the 35-year history of our survey.
He says those surveyed are looking at high unemployment and low consumer confidence. But Dunkelberg, who's also a professor of economics at Temple University, has a larger concern. He worries that too many big idea entrepreneurs are now looking to federal bureaucrats to get money.
They don't have a great record of being very creative or innovative or ingenious or running businesses very well. So the kinds of people who are going to be managing the money, in my mind, are not the kinds of people who can spot the creativity, that have the imaginations that it takes to say, wow, that could really be something.
And he says, great ideas might be missed. But entrepreneurs are, in general, an optimistic bunch. And historically, at least, they've found a way to get things done. Disney, McDonald's, Microsoft, and Google were all founded in tough economic times. As one expert put it, something magical happens in times like these. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
The financial crisis, the story that keeps on giving. We can tell you again this morning, the government is closely monitoring the fragile condition of a major financial services firm. This company is not exactly a household name, but CIT has 1 million business customers who rely on the company for financing everything from buying aircraft to stocking retail shelves. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more on the potential ripple effects of that company's problems.
CIT Group said over the weekend it's trying to keep itself afloat by getting access to cash through a government program or through some other means. But banking expert Bert Ely says that's a tough sell.
CIT is a weak financially. Its debt is rated as junk bonds. So it's really, you know, somewhat borderline.
It's had to pay higher interest rates to obtain the money it loans out to customers, while at the same time, its loan losses keep creeping higher as more of its borrowers default. If CIT winds up in bankruptcy and its ability to lend is really impaired, Ely says the many businesses that depend on it may have to cut back jobs or reduce investment.
Many CIT customers have not been able to get a credit for banks, and to the extent that CIT is not able to meet their needs, they're going to have to look elsewhere.
And banks elsewhere have already tightened their lending. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said yesterday he is monitoring the developments. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Unlike the federal government, states cannot run deficits. They have to balance their budgets. They can either raise taxes or cut spending. Some states, though, have come up with some novel ways to raise money in this recession. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
State budget problems can seem overwhelming because the numbers are so big. Bert Weisenen is a fiscal analyst with the National Conference of State Legislatures.
States had a running number of $121 billion in projected budget gap the last time we checked in April.
He's working on updating that number now. Meantime, he's noticing some trends.
A few states have had to raise income taxes, but they have done so in a temporary way, primarily, and often geared toward the higher income brackets, the upper income earners.
Hawaii, for example, raised income taxes 2.75% on people who make more than $150,000 a year. Even more common than raising income taxes, 12 states have made driving a car more expensive by boosting gas taxes or license fees. Some states have broadened existing definitions on what's taxable to boost revenue. In Kentucky, cell phone ringtones downloaded from the internet now are subject to the state sales tax. Massachusetts and Nevada both increased their sales tax rates. Amber Smith of Boise, Idaho, opposes that.
I don't agree with raising the sales tax. It hurts folks that can least afford it.
Smith was in downtown Denver taking in the sights when told that at least 10 states have raised their tobacco taxes, Florida by a dollar a pack. Smith says she doesn't have a problem with that.
You know, those are choices. You choose to smoke or you choose to drink. And if you don't want to pay the increased cost, those aren't things that are necessary to live.
As you might imagine, someone who smokes has a different point of view. Mitchell Norton is from Fresno, California, and he thinks it's not fair that states tend to focus tax hikes more on tobacco than alcohol.
It's a much easier target for them to raise tobacco tax because the vast majority of people, especially people with families, are going to agree with it, and it's not going to raise too much of a political stink when they do so.
Several states also have increased their taxes on tourists. In Nevada, the hotel tax is now up to 12%. Kim Rubin with the Urban Institute says when lawmakers pass taxes such as that, they're just responding to what their constituents want.
They generally like taxes that they don't have to pay for.
Rubin says constituents also are more likely to agree with taxes if they're tied to specific services like health care or education. Now, here's the bad news from Rubin. The tax increases this year, well, they're probably not going to be enough.
It doesn't seem like the housing crisis and what's going on with real estate is going to turn around anytime soon. I think we're going to have to, you know, tighten our buckles and be in for a little bumpy ride for a while yet.
Gambling is another area states have looked to for money. In New Hampshire and New Jersey, lottery winners will now find their winnings are being taxed at a higher rate than before. And if you want to just get away from it all, well, good luck. Idaho recently raised the cost of hunting and fishing licenses for people who live out of state. In Oregon, prices go up in January. A fishing license will cost $5 extra, and a deer hunting tag will set you back another $4.50. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.